Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I feel like this is kind of, I think this scene kind of commits what just happened. So this reminded me of what just happened at that last section. Okay. Yeah?
Well, this is a fine place you have here, Dr. Gebholzer.
Thank you. And I must say, Professor, your knowledge of engineering is most impressive.
Yes, back home we call him the miracle worker.
Indeed.
Hold on.
May I?
I should say.
Gentlemen, Dr.
Nichols, this is the future.
I offer something to you.
Yes?
I noticed you're still working with polymers.
Still? What else would I be working with?
What else indeed? I'll put it another way. How thick would a piece of your plexiglass need to be at 60 feet by 10 feet to withstand the pressure of 18,000 cubic feet of water?
Well, it's easy. 6 inches. We carry stuff that big and stuff.
I noticed. Now suppose, I were to show you a way to manufacture a wall that would do the same job, but be only 1 inch thick. Would that be worth something to you? Eh?
You're joking. Perhaps a professor could use your computer.
Or the whiteboards.
Computer? Computer?
They've gone back in time to the 1980s.
Hello, computer.
Just use the keyboard.
The keyboard. How quaint.
That's a computer, by the way.
Transparent aluminum?
That's the ticket, laddie.
And then he says, it would take years to work this out. And he goes, well, we could just erase it if you want. I said, no. So you were given transparent aluminum last time. This is also disappointing because it sets me up for failure. Because now I've got to land this plane after we've set this up. Because so far, if I remember correctly, we started off last night with what was the problem with modern moral philosophy. You didn't know in the background that Truman was here, right? And basically every bad action. But Truman, definitely. Okay, for her. Historical contingent otherwise. Okay. But we wanted to move to a good ethics. You know, it'd be good to have this. We can't just go directly because we have to go to action theory. That's why I did this first morning. And then we had that tension where the actual understanding of this system, which I'm going to refer to, once we now have a sense of what it means to be in action, which is to fall under a particular question. It's description responding to the question why. You can't ask rocks why, you can't ask particles why, you can't ask squirrels why, you can ask humans why, when for why they do something. They can give you a series of because, why that, and then they can go down the chain, how. Right? Ends and means sort of thing. That is the structure of human action. That's intentional action. And I didn't have to change human action, intentional action. The distinction that Thomas Aquinas makes sometimes, which Anscombe makes, of course, as well, is the difference between human action and acts of a human. It is true, of course, that there are many things that happen to you that are just like acts of you as a body. Like you weigh certain things, and if you get pushed off, you know, the top of this building, I say, I'm going to push you off, but don't fall. You don't have any choice over that. But that's not a free act when you fall. Like you're not responding to gravity and going, oh, I got to keep doing this. I got to keep willing to fall at 9.8 meters per second squared. No, you're just falling because you have acts that are associated with just your physicality. But action is about human action. So not acts of a human, but human acts. Acts that are qualified by humanity. They're acts of humans, which have this structure. They're intentional acts. going to avoid the intentional voluntary, not because it's an important distinction, but because I'm not going to make it. Just assume that this is a standard case where these overlap. It's important to make that distinction in certain cases as well, though. Okay. So now we've got to go, and the last step today is to go, now we understand what action is, all right, now we understand what human action is, then we need to talk about, like, what is ethics? We have a sense of, like, what something is, what makes it now good. I teach philosophy of art here, and I spend a lot first class to remind them that it has nothing to do with art criticism. We're not interested in looking at making art, one. We're not interested in knowing what good art is. This is an ontology and metaphysics class. I care about what art is. Once you know what art is, then you can figure out, is that good art or not? But you can't just look at art and figure if it's good or not if you don't know what art is. You have to figure out what art is first, and then you can figure out if it's good or bad art. Same thing, if you're going to figure out what ethics is, you have to know what action is. Then you can figure out what good and bad action is, and that just gives you ethics. No extra things necessary. Okay, so, first start of the retreat, Anscombe raised in the essay, which you should read at some point, Modern Moral Philosophy. She raised three questions, which Dr. Bierschen mentioned. He said he must skip this, not spend a lot of time on the second one. We're going to do a little bit here. What's wrong with modern moral philosophy? She says three things. One, it's missing a philosophical psychology or a philosophy of psychology. It's missing a study of action. Two is, it still uses, these all guys still use law or ought, the moral ought, without a lawgiver or an otter, a moral otter. Right? They've given up on that. They still have this notion of the law, the moral law, and ought, and I mean moral ought, but they don't have any backstop for it. They've given up on that sort of thing. She says it's best to just forget that, you know, for now, because you're not capable of it. And third is, and this is a key one, is consequentialism, which, as Dr. Pearson said, the paleo-consequentialism, is it denies moral absolutes. Neo-consequentialism, or the consequentialism today, is like the weighing out of things. That's true, but her claim is that it denies moral absolutes. That's the core of consequentialism. That's all the philosophy except for this. Okay. Her goal in ethics, I take it, is to offer an account of ethics that includes moral absolutes from human action itself. That is, reflecting on human action, in a sense, we've got all the tools, or most of the tools that we need, to now get our absolutes in order. We thought they were tied to an otter, right, or a divine lawgiver, but they're not. They don't need to be. They could be, and maybe some of them are, but we can come up with moral absolutes that are just from the notion of human action itself. That's her claim. Okay? What she's trying to do, take, I think, Moses and Paul, add Aristotle, that's Anscombe. Okay? She's trying to get an absolute conception of ethics, get the absolute conception with an Aristotelian account so that we can have both of these. You could do this also by saying she's trying to give you Thomas plus Wittgenstein, and that gives her. But you might think that Thomas is just a neo-Aristotelian and Wittgenstein is just a neo-Aristotelian. Okay, and then he kind of adds up. You can do the Hegelian ladder kind of triangles on the side. Okay, but that's what it takes. She's going for it. I'm going to fail at achieving this here. One, because I'm not Dr. Bierschen. Two, because she's just getting started. We'll end with this at some point. But we're just now ready that we've figured out what human action is to actually start sorting out this ethics business. Okay, so it's just the beginning. So get excited. Okay, you're part of the new thing. All right. She says the prohibition of certain things simply in virtue of their description as such and such identifiable kinds of action, right? The description of the action, not anything else. Not like, what about that outside business? What about this sort of thing? What about the glow, right? And we'll get to that in a second. No, just from the description of the action. If I describe an action according to this theoretic model here, I should be able to get prohibitions of certain things, regardless of any further consequences, certainly not the whole of the Hebrew Christian ethic. We saw this earlier at the first one, but it is a noteworthy feature of it. And if every academic philosopher in your sense, Sedgwick, has written in such a way as to exclude this ethic, it would be, argue, certain provinciality of mind that they don't even care about this thing, right? To see this incompatibility as most important fact about these philosophers. This is why consequentialism, she said, look, all the British philosophers, all the academic philosophers today, yeah, they're different, they're saying different things, but at the end of the day, the key thing is they deny moral absolutes. And they have different ways of getting other things and how to make sure it's not like crazy world, But that's a fundamental difference. That's what unites them all together.
All right.
The difference between them is somewhat trifling by comparison. Okay. So, how does this look in ethics, then? Well, you have divine command theory, which is moral absolutes and a divine lawgiver. This seems straightforward enough, right? If God speaks, he gives law. If anyone's going to give moral absolutes, God's able to do it. That's the claim of divine command theory. You might think of modern moral theory as saying, well, we deny the divine lawgiver, and so we can't get moral absolutes. That looks like her claim, right? That, look, moral absolutes, divine lawgiver. Okay, so it looks like this. If I want moral absolutes, then I need to have a divine lawgiver. I should give up on moral absolutes if you're a modern moral philosopher guy, because you don't have divine lawgiving. Right? So if you're, don't give me this moral ought business, unless you have the author there. Now, of course, you know from logic, you flip this around, that means no divine lawgiver, no moral absolutes. But I take it, and this is my construction, and Dr. Beers can come in on this, because that paper is, like everything in Anscombe, hard to make sense of. She doesn't actually believe this equation, right? Divine lawgiver, then moral absolutes. So no divine lawgiver, no moral absolutes, right? She thinks that's one way of going, but she thinks that moral absolutes are not necessarily divine laws. Like, you want to break... So the law conception of ethics that you're not entitled to without a lawgiver... It's not the only conception that's absolutes. You've just conflated divine law with moral absolutes. So you've run together, right, St. Paul and Moses, and thought, well, if you got to have absolutes, you got to have these guys, and Aristotle can't have them. And her claim is no. If we think about it right, we'll be able to get them. And that's all. That's what we want anyway, right? Because the other thing's not morality, it's just economics. Okay, in present-day philosophy, an explanation was required how an unjust man is a bad man. That's, right now, the problem. Or an unjust action, a bad one. To give such an explanation belongs to ethics. So now we're bringing moral terms in. You notice Dr. Beerson had stayed assiduously away from moral vocabulary as best he could. Right, and he can, until the question and answer when you ask more. But I can just do action without any moral terms. We're just starting the structure. It's like I can do logic without doing any substantive terms. Doesn't matter if they're toads or not. I can do structures. If X, then P. Okay. Or if E, then Y. That kind of thing. For the proof that an unjust man is a bad man require a positive account of justice as a virtue. Her claim is, we're just in a position now that we've got the right psychology to start figuring out what it means to be and unpack what it means to be a good human being. Because now we know what it means to be a human being acting. Now we can figure out what it means to be a good human actor. So we're going to unpack a little bit of that. Okay. So the question then, in the intentional action part, we'd ask the question, what is an intentional action? All right. Now we want to ask ourselves, what is a virtuous action? An action that is the characteristic of a virtue. And her claim is it's a good human action. It's a good human action. Right. Well, what makes, this is the question that you want to refuse, just like you want to refuse the question about, like, what makes a human action intentional? Like, what's that glow? She says, well, what makes good human action, right, moral human action? How do I attach moral to a good, I've got good human action, I get that, that's reasoning, right? But how do I make, what do I distinguish between good human action and moral human action? Right? And the answer is, what part of intention did you not understand? Once you have good human action, that's all you need to get what you want. Right? Look at it this way. Here's the wrong way, we said, to think about action. Right? Intentional action equals some action, right? Some bodily movement, some kind of thing, plus I, the intention. Now, we don't know where that is. Is it physiological? Is it psychological? We'll sort it out, right? That's what we're on a hunt for. Because we want to find, for intentional action, we got to find action plus that sort of thing. By the way, the curly, I make a distinction for the Q, curly Qs or whatever there. That means it's a set, so it's objects, referring to actions and intentions that added to them. Okay, we'll meet my other convention in a moment. Okay, keeps things straight philosophically. All right. This leads, if you have this account of action, you're going to have, she says, this account of ethics. Moral action is action plus M. Something that makes it moral. right? You're going to have all, you could say everything about the actions, you know, moving here to there, moving your hand, pumping, doing this kind of thing. You're going to have to add something to that description, the description of physical things, human actions, and that's going to give it a moral color, right? That's how you think about this. If intention is added to action, well, then intention and morals are involved here, so therefore morals must be added to action, right? But no, the right way to think about action is not to think about, right, you have this on the sheet, is not to think about actions and plus intentions, but rather actions falling under. So this bracket here is to observe concepts. So it means applying the concept to something. So remember, we ask ourselves, what is an intentional action? It's an action that falls under the question why. You can give a description that has the response to the question why, right? So if a rock is falling and if I ask it why, it's not an action because it can't respond. It's not the kind of thing. Not something added to it. It's just not the kind of thing that takes to that. So actions don't get intentions added. They fall under. They count as intentional if they're the right kind of action, right? This leads to a better way to think about ethics. The moral is not something that's added to some action that then makes it moral action. Rather, it's action that falls under morality, right? It's a description. Is why do that? Same description, except it has the good aimed at it. In a stock phrase or a catchphrase, action description is what we want, not action addition. So morality is not an action plus. It's just the right description of the same action, because that action is based upon the good. You might say, now hold on, where did the good come from? But you already know in the chain here, the good is what's motivating. It's got to be a good reason. You've got to have an end. An end is a good to be done. So the good is already baked in to our account of human action. There's not neutral human actions and movements of things, and then there's good ones, and then some of those good ones are, if they're in the right circumstances, moral ones. We just kind of keep stacking things. No, there's actions which have good baked in because they wouldn't be human actions if they didn't have good it aimed at, because you couldn't get the syllogism working. The why, right? Because the good is what it's attracted to. So good's already in there, and good is just what the moral action is. Right? Because we don't get duped by the finding the intention added to something. And it's just there. All right? Okay, that's the schematic. Now, so that means, right, there's our intentional saxophone, there's the intention, he's playing it intentionally, right? And we've all been duped, like, that's not, there's no glow that makes a saxophone player intentionally playing the saxophone, right? He's just playing the saxophone intentionally, right? You can't, what if we take off the saxophone playing and what's left of the intentional? Nothing, right? Anscombe, I think, says the same thing about, like, the intentional truth teller, the moral truth teller, I should say, right? It's not like you can tell the truth, but then the question is it moral to do it? Like, this is the action, telling the truth. Read my lips, no new taxes, right? And then the question is, well, okay, well, is it moral to tell the truth, right? Like, what's the moral glow to it, you know, that makes it the moral act of truth telling as opposed to good old-fashioned truth telling? Just standard truth-telling. You know, the kind of thing that people do without thinking about morals. Right? Just like good old-fashioned saxophone playing. The kind of saxophone you play, you do when you're not trying to, when you're not intending to. Right? That's the parallel here. Okay? So she says, what has become now of the notion, here's her question, of the morally good or morally bad as applied to human actions? They have become equivalent to good and bad as applied to human actions as such. I mean, that was a morally good action. If you praise someone for a morally good action, she says, that's equivalent to qua human action, as human action, that was good. Or, that was a good human action. Just like, we don't need to add, was that intentional human action? Or intentional saxophone playing? No. If it's a good human action, then it's a moral human action. Right? Nothing, don't need anything else on that. Now, I should say, this also, so this is the consequentialists have been taking a beating for this. But I wonder, and this is, I'm see what Dr. Bierson thinks about this. Divine command theory might have the same issue. Right? We'll call it the moral glow addition thesis. right? To get something to be moral, you have to add glow to it. It's very clear why consequentialism has this case, right? So you have, like, there are neutral actions, and you've got to figure out in what circumstances and according to what thing you can glow them up, right? And then they're good actions to do, right? Telling the truth, you know, no, we're not talking about telling the truth. Don't go there yet. Let's just go with speaking to someone. That's the neutral action. And then let's put the glow on it. If it's yellow, that's good because it's the right thing to do in this situation. Or if it leads to bad consequences, let's put the red glow on it. That's a bad action. But just speaking words to each other, don't say truth, just telling words to each other, that's neutral. That's a neutral action that then I glow up in either color depending on good or bad, right? That's quite clear why that's a problem for why this account takes work on that, right? But I think I wonder if the divine command theorist, although she doesn't mention this, I wonder if the divine command theorist is kind of in the same thing, right? Because you might think the divine command theorist, why is something like murder wrong? All right, we've got a Euthyphro dilemma going on here, right? And so you might think that what is wrong is because God commands it. You might think, well, cool, that's fair enough. That's a moral absolute if there is one. But then you could say, now, hold on a second. Did he have to command it that way? So isn't he the circumstance? Isn't he the glower? Right? Doesn't he glow it up if you go that route? So at the end of the day, is Anscombe is this account the only one that makes sense of absolutes? You can't have the divine ones? Hold on, let's take a look at that. Blessed SCOTUS, no one would ever say this, right? God can't will murder. So Blessed SCOTUS, Blessed John SCOTUS, the Franciscan, right? He says this. He's dealing with the question of the law. He says, basically, with the Ten Commandments, the first three, because they have to do with God, those are necessary, like mathematical truths. But everything on what's called the second table, so honor your parents, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet, blah, blah. Those, they're up for grabs, right? For there is no goodness in the things that those precepts command, thou shalt not murder, for example, that is necessary for the goodness of the ultimate end. And there is no badness in the things they prohibit, like murder, that is necessarily turns aside, one aside from the ultimate end. All right? Just because you murder doesn't mean you might not go to heaven if you repent. It might actually be leading to your conversion, right? So Duns Scotus here says, like, look, yeah, we live in a good place because we have the Ten Commandments we have, but God could have, right? So right now, this is so red as the bad. So stabbing, like hunting men, right? That's evil. It's red. That's against the fifth commandment. No murder, right? But, I mean, if he didn't command it, it could just be murder, but not, like, it's neutral. And so it's a matter of prudential judgment, whether at any moment you murder the person next to you, right? You kill them. We might change the word murder a little bit, but, like, it's just a prudential thing, like whether I should walk here or there or get coffee or tea, murder you, you know, kill you or not, right? Now, that's, like, you might think, oh, my gosh, it's good, because if you live in that world, imagine. But you could start to develop a notion of how we would live in this kind of world, right? You'd be watching your back all the time, you know? You'd be, like, keeping distance, be like COVID, be kind of distanced there. Kind of stuff, right? And now it gets even scarier, right? Now this, I'm not sure if this goes through. But what what if it was Game of Thrones world, right? So this, I call this the murder kingdom, right? So this is like Disney World's Animal Kingdom, but it's with murder, okay? So you get worried, like, now hold on a second. So it turns out I have this kind of hunch that, like, both divine command theorists and consequentialists see morality as added, right, to good human actions. Right, so it's the glow factor kind of business, right? I worry about this. Okay, it's clear consequentialism. But Anscombe and Aristotle see morality as good human actions, right? As good human actions, not added, okay? Descriptions, not additions, okay? So no new taxes. If that's true, it's good. Well, it depends what the don't need to glow that up, right? That's just a good act. Truth-telling. Truth-telling is always good. That's what it means to tell the truth. Okay? The idea of the moral as an aspect that is seen in some human actions or felt by the agent, which is lacking if it is not felt by the agent, this idea is rejected by the equation. Here's her equation. Human action equals moral action. At least human action equals moral action of a human being. Right? So it's qua human, not act of a human. She says, and human beings. For I'm not talking about angels, demons, fairies, or Martians. We might have to figure out a different moral structure for them, right? Okay. I shall hope to show that this equation is not a mere existential equivalence. That means it's not just the case that good actions and moral actions have to happen to fall under the same class. You know, like, they're this class of good actions, this class of moral actions. Turns out they're the same class, right? Class of equilateral triangles with the same sides and triangles with the same angle thing. That turns out to be that you could distinguish those, but they're extensionally equivalent, right? I can talk about triangles of the same size, equilateral, and then the same angles, and that's a different thing, but the same triangles. She says, no. I don't mean like moral actions and good actions just happen to line up. Right? They are the same thing. They're intentionally equivalent. They're equivalent in content, right? In meaning. Let's take an example of this. Okay. So murder as killing plus evil, right? So this is the, if you didn't take this view, if you took the glowed up view, right, you would view murder as this kind of thing that there was a killing involved, you know, taking of a life, a human life, but then you want to know, well, hold on, is there evil there? Like, is there the glow? Have we added the red part to it? Right? And he says, murder, she says, is a complex concept with many disparate elements in it. But you don't have to know what some private person killed his uncle in order to know he committed murder. Right? So if some private person, she does that because she doesn't want, like, the war criminals, that's excluded at the end there. Okay? All you need to know is that so long as he was awake, compos mentis, so in his right mind, right, and was doing the killing on purpose, that's all you need for it to be murder and wrong. And you haven't added anything in there that's actually like, whoop, circumstance. Just added the, it's just the act itself, right? Because you're going to have in that chain killing this particular person who's, assume your uncle's innocent in this case, right? You're going to have slotted in that chain an evil, right? And there's nothing added on extra to that. It's just part of the act, right? Those things, okay? This is a bit like on The Simpsons. This is to demonstrate the side effects issue. So, like, you can't, like, you know, you should do the side effects issue too, as well. All right, pay attention to this.
Get out! Okay, but on my way, I'm gonna be doing this. If you get hit, it's your own fault.
Okay, then I'm gonna start kicking air like this. And if any part of you should feel that air, it's your own fault.
I better go check that out. Now, Homer, don't you eat this pie.
Okay. All right, I'm just going to do this. And if you get eaten, it's your own fault.
No! No! Oh, my!
Get up!
Okay, so you do need to take into account, right, the side constraints on there, so they're still responsible for hitting each other. But the other part I like about that is it has a sense of, like, detaching the part of the action from the whole schema, right? Like, you can, I'm just spinning my arms. I'm just pumping this thing, right? I'm just signing a document. Nothing else, right? And so it has this notion of, so this is when she talks about applying this. I call this is the applied part of it. This should be the murder aspect, right? When you have just pure action, the idea that there's some neutral action that then the circumstances will determine, and how do I do that, right? So think about shooting someone. So assume this is an innocent person again. This person's got the gun. Okay, shooting someone. Now, you could describe this. This is like the pumping thing, right? You could describe this a bunch of ways. This is pulling a gun's trigger. That's true, right? It's also sending bullets to a head of an innocent person. It's a sort of like postal exchange, right? Okay. It's also killing an innocent person, because if you go to the head, then okay. It's also bringing about. Imagine it's for the good. Don't know how, but it's for some good. Who knows, right? Who knows? Now the question is, right? Can you stop at this one? Right. Can you stop and say, look, I am not held responsible for these other things. I'm just doing the pulling the trigger bit. You know? If if that board happens to hit that guy's head, right? I didn't do it. I just pulled the trigger, and this just causally connected, and you know, causal connect. No. This won't work because the only reason, this is the Anscombe thing, why are you pulling the trigger? I'm just pulling it. No, you're to do this thing, right? You have to have some insight, right? Well, maybe you say, yeah, well, I'm all right, fine. I'm pulling the trigger to send the bullets, right? Can you stop here? No, because that's not a good. I mean, I guess you could find someone to, like, you know, shooting off guns. But this is like, I'm aiming at his head. I'm sending the bullets to his head. I don't care about when they hit or anything else. Like, I'm pulling trigger to send bullets to his head. That's it. Would you be convinced by that sort of description of an action? No, of course not. And you say, oh, well, I'm not going to kill an innocent person, right? So I'm going to jump over that, right? I'm just going to go ahead and bring about the kingdom of God, right? Can you skip that? And the answer of Anscombe, of course, is no. And what's the problem here? And the problem is we have now a moral premise, an evil that's stuck in there, right? In the middle, in the path. And this means that when you have the ends here, you have a good, and as you move up, you have to make sure, because these are all ends on the way up, right? I do this because this end, this is the means to this end, this is the means to this end, this is the means to this end. Each of these has to be good, right? And with this account, you have one of these as a not good thing. Unless you want to claim that killing innocent people is fine, right? But Anscombe's claim, I think, on that is, no one's going to agree with you. You might have said, look, we might have to kill some innocent people to get to the place where we don't have to kill innocent people, right? A little dirty hands issue. Look, I know we want to be a good place, but we just gotta, look, it'd be better, people will fall in love if we just kill an innocent person once in a while, right? Just make a case of it. And then it'll be a better, right? But the problem is, with Anscombe, you can't do, like, any evil for a good, you might think, well, why not? Because you have a practical contradiction. You have, up here you say, is killing innocent people good? No. Is killing innocent people in the third one good? If it's an end, it has to be. And since you have these all together, the act of will is the whole thing, the whole chain together, you know, out in spans, not like going, I wonder why I'm pulling this trigger. Oh, I wonder why I'm sending those, oh, because I'm sending the guy's head. Why am I sending the guy's head? Oh, because I want to kill, oh, no. It's all together, right? That means that you have a practical contradiction, because you're saying it's not good, and it's good at the same time. And just like logic, right, principle of non-contradiction, you can't hold P and not P at the same time, in the same respect, right? So in practical logic, you can't put in something you wouldn't want at the end, because then you'd have a practical contradiction. The practical reason would contradict itself. Your will couldn't do it, right? Now, you might be confused about what is good, of course, because people do this. Just like some people are confused about what is true in contradiction, right? But if you're looking at it straightforwardly, no. All right. Why? Because they're all at the same time, the whole thing. So if you got one in there, you got a practical contradiction. Okay. So that's, yeah. So guns don't kill people. He's right. You do. You can't blame it on the gun. Okay? All right. So this means that although the mental element of mens res, mental composure, is important to identify as killing as a murder, the question whether someone has committed a murder can usually be answered as soon as the relevant facts are in. What was he doing? And having the facts in doesn't mean that all have ascertained is the occurrence of a pre-moral evil. The concern of, well, there's neutral acts, and then we got to glow it up or down. We don't, no. When you know what happened, you know what that person did. And then you know whether it was good or bad because of what you count as goodness or badness, which I haven't explained yet, but we will. Okay, second one is the harder case, amputation. Right? Because amputation looks like a case where actually you've put in an evil premise in your chain. Right? Why are you cutting? Why are you sawing? Because I want to cut off that limb. Why do you want to cut off the limb? To save the person's life. Well, but the second premise there, right? Cut off that limb. You might think, well, that's an evil. right? Just cutting off a limb is moral action description by my criteria. So cutting off a limb is one of these stages you can have, cutting off a limb. And it's also, she says, indeterminate, suggesting evil. It's interesting, maybe Dr. Bierson can come back on this. Raising the question of excuse justification. It's one of those things that you can't, that you can do, but you have to have a reason for it, right? This is different than, like, a moral prohibition. Now, you might think cutting off limbs of people is always evil in every space. But I think she wants you to realize that you're not committed to that. There's no prohibition on that sort of thing. But it is something that has the suggestion of evil. Why? Because it's against the human good. Right? But it's not fundamentally against the human good, right, is her claim. Now, this is tricky. When we know that the answer to those questions, we should be able to tell the quality of the act, right? The thing that makes it of importance for our discussion is the dominant role of the question, what for? Again, in order for what? If this role is described by reference to a greater good, then the road is thrown open to a generalization which threatens to destroy many absolute prohibitions of kinds of act. So our concern is, you've got to be careful with this case, because if you say, when I cut off that limb, right, it's because the greater good, some nebulous concept of this thing, then you start opening up the kind of consequentialism concerns. So she says, the important thing about a justified amputation, you have to justify it. You can't just go around and saw people's legs off, right? I take it this is, unless we live in SCOTUS, you know, amputation kingdom, okay? As we in civilized countries understand it, is that it is for the life, health, and capacity function of the individual human being who suffers it. I think this is the important difference between this and some utilitarian concern. The lesser evil for that human being's physical condition or integrity is chosen for the sake of the greater good of that human being's life or condition or capacity. So the amputation case, although it looks like a case of, doing evil so the good it's in the case of the same person, I take it, the same subject. That's what I think she's pointing at is makes it this issue. Right, and Dr. Pearson's hopefully nodding. Yeah, nailed it, nice, okay. All right, this leads to the Anscombe thesis, which, so right now, like, yeah, so what's the big deal here, right? This is obviously good, okay? It's this is the Anscombe thesis, I call it. All human action is moral action. It is all either good or bad. Here's the... Because, right, if we've replaced moral action with good or bad action, action is either good or bad. There's no neutral action. She says there are neutral act descriptions, but the act itself has to be either good or bad. It's got to be aiming towards a good or away from it. Every one of them. There's no neutral actions, good or bad. It's like you're either successful or unsuccessful. At something, right? And the problem now is we used to, when we said, well, there's good and bad successes, you know, good saxophone playing here, but like, was it the moral thing to do, right? But we're no longer able to say that. We're now, if it's good saxophone playing, it is the moral thing. Like, so what does this mean? This seems an extraordinary thing to say, for aren't there perfectly neutral actions? Like, for example, picking a dandelion flower as I walk along, or indeed walking along from one point to another. Right? If you're walking through a field and you're picking a dandelion and someone says, are you doing that well? Like you got it in one grasp as opposed to like missing it. And someone goes, whoa, moral action. You know, like well done. And you might think, this sounds crazy. Right? It's a neutral action. And then it might be in a context like if someone says, I'm going to kill this child unless you pick this dandelion. Then it becomes like, oh, now it's a moral action. Right? But just by itself, I'm just picking a dandelion or I'm just walking. Morality, you know? Like walking well, you might think, whoa, this is, right? Question, no neutral actions, right? To say this, right, to this I'd say, here's a response. There are neutral action descriptions. So I can list out action descriptions, right? Remember, that original question, what is the action description? Stop it. If there was only one, and you had neutral action descriptions, then you could choose that neutral action to be the act description, right? And I could just have neutral. But because we're no longer duped by the kind of only one, we know that all actions have many descriptions, and the form of them is to bring them into the line and realize some of them descriptions are side cases and other ones are for the good, are logic. Once we structure that, we can say, well, there's no neutral acts, but there might be neutral act descriptions just hanging around.
right? But this does not mean that a real action so described but will be neither good action nor bad, but will be a neutral action, right? This is good. Okay, that seems fair, but it does still, so at least it's logical, it makes sense. You can have neutral act descriptions, but is that enough? You know, do we want, like, our morality to go all the way down? You might have thought, man, divine command theorists, people are so rigorous. They're just, God is commanding, they're moralists and all this kind of thing. Aristotle's nice because he just tells you you can have slaves sometimes, just blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, he's not that demanding. Now Anscombe's like, oh, no. We've got, like, the worst of all possible worlds, right? Because now we have not only divine commands, but thankfully only give some of those. There are a lot, you know, and it depends if you're Hebrew or Christian, but there's a lot of commands, but there's some things I can just do, just hang out, you know? But now, since the moral commands aren't doing the glowing up business, that's all kind of there, it's just good action, now everything is moral, right? Or vicious, right? To say that human action and moral action of human are equivalent is to say that all human action in concreto, in the actual act, is either good or bad simpliciter. There's no need to insert morally or say morally good or bad. I'm impounding this. Moral goodness is goodness of actions, passions, habits of actions and feeling. All the way, you're human. Anything that's human about you is either good or bad as you act upon it. No neutral acts, although there might be neutral act descriptions. Is this really, though, incredible? I'm going to defend it for a second. All right. Is it really incredible? When you think about Aristotle, think about his moral virtues, right? As you've read the Nicomachean Ethics, which you're all Ivy League students, you have done this. If you have not, you need to do it. Even if you don't like Aristotle, some people don't. You should read this book. Smart people are smart. Never forget that. Okay, if you read that categorization, you read the, here's some of the moral virtues that show up. Of course, moral virtues for him is just practical virtues because he's an Anscombian. Okay, so, right? It's true. He's like a paleo-neo-Anscombian. Okay, this gets complicated. You show up, of course, courage shows up, right? That's a virtue. Fine. Moderation is temperance, okay? Magnificence, okay? If he's spending lots of money well and being endowing things, blah, blah, blah. So you gotta have skill in that. Liberality, doing the small things, you know? If a beggar comes up to you, you know how to give to him properly. And those sort of things, that's fine. Magnanimity, the greatness of soul, you know? Okay, that's the whole kind of shoot and match, right? Ambition, you gotta have a little drive. He uses the same word for the vice and the virtue in this case, but that's okay. It's just, you know what he means, right? You should have some, you know, whatever you say, stop it, okay? All right, and then you get gentleness, and you're like, oh, meekness, all right. Well, that sounds kind of Christian. Cool, Aristotle's not a bad guy, right? And then you get truthfulness, and you're like, yeah, that's good. And the wittiness. And then friendliness, you're like, what the fuck? Oh, and then don't forget justice. That's after them. So don't forget wittiness, friendliness, and justice. These are the moral virtues that you... And you might think, well, hold on a second. Like, is wittiness really like justice and courage? And I mean, isn't that kind of like a social virtue, maybe, or an etiquette or something, right? But if she's right, if Anscombe's right and Aristotle's right, like, and he doesn't seem to know, he doesn't mark and go, now here's some etiquette lessons. Alright? He says, look, you gotta be courageous and moderate and magnificent and magnanimous and just and witty and friendly with people, right? And you might think that just seems weird. But think about it for a second. Right? And this is a weird group, so this might not work. But just think about it. Imagine, you know, you have that friend, right? But they just don't ever get jokes. They always tell the wrong ones. They can't really just be with They just send the wrong point. They're just not... They don't know how to take a joke. They get offended easily. They're just kind of... They're just not witty. They don't have the kind of eutropalia that, you know... You know, maybe they should work on that. Like, maybe they're not as good a human being if they can't take a joke and understand when you're joking or not. Like, maybe you should know how to deploy certain kind of jokes to be a human. Like, maybe... Laughing is part of social interaction. If you don't ever laugh, it hurts the community, and that's your fault. And, you know, we might blame you for it. And maybe if we blame you for it, it might be kind of morally bad, right? Or friendliness, right? Like, you know, this is a person who's just on edge all the time, just can't get along. You know, just, no, it's going to be this sort of thing. Just won't tolerate kind of general human stuff. Everyone makes a mistake. This person is just, really is impossible to get along with. Like, it's really, you're always working, and you're like his only friend because, you know, no one else, like, is always turning on you. And then he keeps doing, you're like, ah, you know, John, I feel like you should, no, you shouldn't change because it's not a virtue. It's just kind of a psychological fact about you. It doesn't make you better or worse. It's a neutral kind of description of things. Maybe it's not. Maybe being friendly is like being a good human being. And maybe you should work on that because it hurts people when you're not. And hurting people is like a bad kind of. And so maybe everything could. Now, it's not like, guy can't take a joke. Kill him. Okay? Unless SCOTUS tells you, right? But like, but you might think, you know, all said and done, it'd be better if you could take a joke. You know, it's like Dominicans are always making fun of Jesuits because we have this long rivalry with them. It's a bit like, I assume it's like Notre Dame and Purdue. Like, Purdue thinks Notre Dame is a rival of it, so they're always attacking, you know, Notre Dame. And Notre Dame's like, you're not a rival against us. Like, whatever, guys. So, like, Dominicans are always, like, attacking Jesuits. Like, Jesuit, when's the last time you've seen a Protestant, you know, an Albigensian around? But, you know, you've seen a bunch of Protestants, right? We were founded for Albigensians. They were founded to get rid of Protestants. But here we are, evangelical guys on the street. One, that was our fault. Johannes Tetzel was the one who was a Dominican preaching when Martin Luther was around, saying, when a coin in the coffer rains a soul in purgatory springs. So we started that fire. Okay. And Albigensians, let's just say they're still with us, okay? All right. But like every time I do a Jesuit joke at a group thing, someone is going to come up with me. It's always happened. Someone always comes up to me and goes, you know, I was a Jesuit trained person, you piece of garbage. I'm like, can you not take a joke? Like, why are you such a bad person? You have had these thoughts, right? And they're right. Okay? All right, let's finish up here. I thought this was, speaking of Luther, I thought this was interesting. So I've been working my research recently on the Lutheran influences on philosophy, and it's really interesting accounts on this kind of stuff. And the 21st Heidelberg dissertation thesis, it's a comparing between the theologian of glory, you know, the Catholic scholastic, and the theologian of the cross, the Lutheran theologian. He says, the theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil, and the theologian of the cross says what a thing is. I like that. And then I thought this. Anscombe says, this is Anscombe's Heidelberg Dissertation 21. The modern moral philosopher calls evil good and good evil, right? Because the consequence is like, massacre these people. That's a good, we should reward you for that, right? When like striking an attitude is a, you know, that's a problem, right? Sort of thing. But the Christian Aristotelian says what a thing is. No glow. Just what it is. I like that. That's her getting. That's from the early picture, right? She's getting hatted by this cardinal before she gives that amazing talk on human essence in Navarre. Okay, I suppose it's Mystic Institute, so I should say something about Thomas Aquinas. So I'm going to quote someone, not Thomas. Okay, this is a great book. So this is Thomas Osborne's book, not too long ago, on Thomas Aquinas on virtues. And at the end of it, so he deals. It's a great analytic account of kind of Thomistic virtue stuff with history and background. At the end of it, he talks about the comparison with modern virtue ethics, what's called, a kind of neo-Aristotelianism stuff. And he says this, I like this. The separation of moral good from the human good, what I've been talking about, is an artifact of later philosophical and theological debates. This he's talking about in Thomas's day. That's false, actually. But don't worry, it's more or less, it's fine, we'll take it. Okay. Although it may have roots in ancient philosophy. And Anselm. Okay, Thomas Aquinas and most of his contemporaries deny the possibility of such a separation. To be morally good is to be just good, right? If you're striving for happiness, eudaimonia, you don't tend to say, well, but ought you be happy? No, happiness and morality go together, right? He says, Elizabeth Anscombe suggested that philosophers should refuse to use the term moral and moral ought unless they show how it makes sense in light of their account of human nature. If, as many philosophers suspect, the modern concept of such a separate morality is confused beyond repair, its absence from Thomas's ethics would be a strength. But meanwhile, this is Anscombe in Modern Moral Philosophy, is it not clear there are several concepts that need investigating simply as part of the philosophy of psychology? And, as I should recommend, banishing ethics totally from our minds. We've seen this quote before, right? So let's do the ethics. Namely, to begin with, action, intention, pleasure, and wanting. More will probably turn up if we start with these. Eventually, it might be possible to advance to considering the concept of virtue. Well, we've been kind of grasping at here. With which, I suppose, we should be beginning some sort of study of ethics. Anscombe, I take it, has given us more than just a little bit of that start there. But, like the beginning of the Summa Theologiae, we are just beginners here. That's what I got.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.